I next met with Dr. Clifford Huddis, and to begin, we chatted about genomic biomarkers used in the adjuvant setting to determine whether to use adjuvant chemotherapy or not.
I can't speak for everybody else. I can speak for myself, and I have a kind of very pragmatic and conservative point of view, which I know you've heard from me before. I think all these things should be tested and developed, but the only thing that really matters from a clinical point of view is a test that has been shown to appropriately influence treatment. So knowing that somebody in a good risk category has a somewhat better or worse prognosis doesn't strike me on the surface as worth much. You would have to intuit from that you could make a change in treatment and that change in treatment would be a useful thing to do. And even with its limitations, the only one of these tests that has data in that category is the Oncotype, for better or worse, because they have randomized trial data that shows that the high score is predictive of a chemotherapy benefit. This means, practically speaking, that if you get a high score, you know that that patient is more likely to benefit from chemo. And if you get a low score, you know that they're not so likely to. So you can make a decision. And this has been translated into change in practice in the U.S., where anywhere from 10 to 15% of the patients who used to get chemotherapy are not on the basis of a low Oncotype score. In contrast, when you talk about the other tests, they either have as a first approximation an equivalent prognostication as Oncotype, or they seem to separate patients into groups. But right now, nobody has been able to provide predictive power. And I'm sorry, but I just don't understand the value side of this to spend money. And one of the things that makes me a little crazy, and I see it with surprising frequency, is the patient who either, and this is, you know, you're talking about cases before, so this is a real case for me. A patient has a multifocal tumor. The largest piece of the cancer is 1.1 centimeter in size. A smaller piece is 7 millimeters, and the third piece is 4 millimeters. The tumor is ER positive and HER2 negative. The nodes are negative. And the medical oncologist writes and says, I'm planning to give chemotherapy, but the Oncotype is 8. Do you think I still need to give AC and paclitaxel versus something like TC? And I kind of want to pull my hair out, because the only reason to have spent the cash, there's money involved here, on that Oncotype, is if you're going to respect the results of it to decide on whether to give chemo or not. That's its only utility.
I'm also kind of wondering, you know, at one point there was discussion, and I think a New England Journal paper, talking about the overlap between genomic assays and...
Oh, there was the Fan et al. Piece, which showed that there were 5 different profiles, including one that was just 2 genes, and that they more or less were equivalently prognostic. I agree.
But on the other hand, there was a paper at San Antonio, which again was kind of complicated, and it looked like there wasn't that much overlap.
Well, the gene sets are not overlapping, but their prognostic ability largely is. That was the point.
Hmm.
So that asks the question, you know, what is it that the gene abnormalities that we're measuring are reflecting? Are they functional, or are they actually the downstream consequence of something more fundamental that divides good and bad tumors? But again, from my point of view, what matters isn't tweaking Ms. Smith's prognosis for thousands of dollars. What matters is improving her prognosis by intervening appropriately. And, you know, I don't know, for some reason, this is and maybe it's marketing, but, you know, why would a patient have both a mamma print and an Oncotype performed?
So there was another paper I was going to ask you about. It was a trial in progress looking at AC followed by eribulin.
That was a little pilot study that our group did. You know, when eribulin was superior to dealer's choice chemotherapy, leading to its approval in metastatic disease, for me, even though it's obviously a modest difference, it mattered a lot to me, because the primary endpoint of that trial was overall survival. And that gets us off the mark a little bit when we're arguing about quality of life and PFS and what they mean. If you are living longer, to me, it's kind of like my earlier discussion. First, restrict the calories. Then we can talk about the kind of dietary content. First, get people to live longer, and then we can talk about some of the other aspects. But that, to me, should be the goal of therapy for advanced disease. And so if it was improving survival there, there's obviously a hope that it would make a difference in the adjuvant setting. And so this is a pilot just to begin to move eribulin in that direction. Obviously, it's not hard to imagine that the trial you might want to see someday is this versus dose-dense ACT.
Yeah, so basically replacing the taxane with eribulin.
Perhaps. I mean, or maybe there's a different way to put it together. But if it's an active drug and one of the few that's been shown to change survival in metastatic disease, then it seems to me that we want to give it a shot in the curative setting.
Do you sort of look towards eribulin more in triple-negative breast cancer?
I can't say that I do, although obviously we give more chemotherapy in that setting.
Let's talk about your case or case scenarios. And all these I know you see very, very commonly. And I'm glad you picked these out to talk about because these are the ones we're getting lots of questions about. So beginning with a 48-year-old woman, you see the patient post-op. She's had surgery for a 3.5 centimeter, 7 positive nodes, ER negative, HER2 positive breast cancer. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I identified this case because I wore my heart on my sleeve over the last year on the issue of the exciting new drug pertuzumab. And I want to talk about this in some detail because I think that this is still not completely grasped by everybody, you know, what's going on here. A phenomenal thing has happened right now with this drug, which, you know, if you're not maybe a policy wonk, it may be lost on you. So you have a drug that in its first randomized trial in the metastatic setting adds a dramatic 6 months to progression-free survival and also has a p-value and a pretty remarkable improvement in overall survival, secondary endpoint, in the CLEOPATRA trial. That's a fact. And, you know, we were talking about eribulin a few minutes ago, but you know that you probably can count on one hand and certainly two all the treatments that have ever been documented to improve survival in metastatic disease. So you're optimistic about the drug. And then you launch a big adjuvant trial, which has been our convention for years. We've learned something from the trastuzumab era, so there's really just one big study, Affinity, with whatever 6,000 or 8,000 patients, right, or 5,000. I can't remember the number, but it's a big number, but it's powered to give the answer, and fine, it's cooking. And then you get these pre-op studies that are reported, and Neosphere being the obvious one, with an about doubling of the pathologic complete response rate. And so the community rightly, and the industry rightly says, gee whiz, if we have a drug that increases PCR by that amount, at what point can we acknowledge that that is an accurate predictor of long-term benefit? Because if we can, then we have a tremendous motivation to do a larger proportion of our drug development in the pre-op setting, where you put 500 patients on the trial, you get 500 data points. In contrast, you put 500 adjuvant therapy patients on a trial, you get 50 data points, right? Because most of them do well. And so the idea is, at what point does an improvement in the pathologic CR rate accurately predict long-term benefit and a public health benefit, to be specific? So the FDA weighs into this, and they, of course, published with Cortazar et al. A meta-analysis, which has been a hard paper for a lot of people to completely understand. Yes, PCR is in groups associated with better outcome. That's a fact. But a delta in PCR, a specific improvement in PCR comparing two arms of a trial has regrettably been frustrating. It has not correlated to improved overall survival or disease-free survival. And they published that. And there was one outlier, the NOAA study, in their analysis in the HER2 positives. But so it goes. So now the FDA has a package in front of it, pertuzumab. They have 4 to 6 months of pre-op pertuzumab. They have a doubling of PCR, and they label the drug. And it's not a secret. I was very concerned by this, not because I'm opposed to the drug. I actually will predict that Affinity will be a positive trial, but I don't know anything about it today. I know nothing at all. I want to be clear. It's just my prediction because the CLEOPATRA study was so nicely positive for both disease-free and overall survival, and the drug is active. So my prediction is Affinity will be positive. I could be wrong, but we'll see. The problem I have is that by labeling the drug in a setting where it only increases PCR and giving it on label for 4 to 6 cycles, we have not necessarily accomplished anything. All we've done is increase the PCR rate. The 4 to 6 cycles of treatment is not what's tested in Affinity for disease-free and overall survival. It's about half the treatment.
Could I just add that one other benefit, and maybe it's just very minor compared to the adjuvant or long-term survival benefit, is shrinking down a tumor that needs to be shrunk down for breast conservation.
Absolutely, but put that aside because that amounts to less than 10% of the cases. So if you see a patient who needs a mastectomy but can't get it, we're not even talking about them. Of course, do you treat them? If you see a patient who needs a mastectomy but wants a lumpectomy, you're right. You do everything to get a PCR because you diminish the extent of surgery. But despite the fact that that's an attractive argument, in reality, that turns out to be a rare case. It's fewer than 10% who have the surgery changed. So put that aside for a minute, though. So the FDA labels pertuzumab, and they label it for, what was it, 2 centimeters above, or positive nodes, pre-op. So think about what happens now on Second Avenue. If you walk down 2nd Avenue with a newly diagnosed HER2-positive breast cancer and you made a right-hand turn, you see a surgeon and they do a mastectomy and they send you to the oncologist who can't offer you pertuzumab because it's off-label. If you make a left-hand turn and you see a medical oncologist, they say, good news, there's a new drug, we think it's going to be even more life-saving than trastuzumab was, and because your tumor is intact, I'm going to give it to you. But on the label, I'm going to give it for 4-6 cycles. That's all there is. And what I'm asking today is, in 2017 or 18, whenever you hear about Affinity, will you be able to say that this patient in 2014 was helped or not? And the answer is you won't be able to say it, because what you're giving them today is not what's being tested for survival. So maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not. So I actually thought that if they were going to label the drug this way, if they were going to give it accelerated approval, it would have been nice to do it as per the Affinity study while it's pending. And then, as they plan, if the Affinity's negative, yeah, you withdraw the label. That's what they're going to do anyway. This approval for pre-op therapy is an accelerated approval that's contingent on Affinity being positive. So I still struggle with the way that this sort of clouds the treatment of patients, and it's confusing to the oncology community. So I think that the patient should get a year of pertuzumab if they would have qualified pre-op.
Does that mean that before you saw the ALTO trial, you thought they should get lapatinib?
Well, no. And the difference for me was that, A, a lot of my colleagues did think that, but I didn't. But lapatinib never had an overall survival improvement in metastatic disease. That's part A. And part B is lapatinib never had a pre-op label.
They did, though, show an improvement in PathCR.
That's not the point. This drug, pertuzumab, got labeled for pre-op therapy. And my point is it got labeled in a way that's neither fish nor fowl.
Well, that I understand. I guess one thing I've heard a lot of confusion about is the NCCN stance on this, which you're part of. Can you explain that?
I'm espousing the point of view of the NCCN, which is, if your tumor would have qualified you for pre-op therapy, why are you denied that same drug just because you happen to make a right turn into a surgeon's office first?
I got to say that that point, which was picked up by everybody, I mean, every community oncologist knows about that, in a way was a departure for the NCCN, at least what I've observed with them over the years. And for whatever reason, it was related to the FDA, whatever it is, the bottom line is they kind of endure something for which there really isn't data.
I can only say, since you probably could figure this out, that I was passionate about this issue.
I understand. And, you know, it reminds me, you know, we did a survey, I love to show, a National Survey of Oncologists in February 2005. And we presented a bunch of patients with 10 positive nodes and HER2 positive, everything. And nobody, not the community, not the investigators, was given adjuvant trastuzumab. And obviously that completely changed a few months later. But, you know, it's easy to say, well, we have to wait for the data.
But here, if the FDA had not labeled it for pre-op, we wouldn't be having this discussion. My point is that this pre-op pathway to approval opens up a set of complexities that we have to really dissect. And so these are patients with curable disease. The only reason to give them an additional drug is either A, because you think you're going to change the nature of their surgery, and that's a rare accomplishment, or B, you believe that by changing their PCR rate, you're improving their disease-free and overall survival. You can't come up with a third reason to do it.
I guess my only point is I don't remember the NCCN making this kind of recommendation in this kind of situation.
So all I will say again, speaking for myself, I'm not speaking for ASCO, I'm not speaking for Memorial, and I'm not speaking for the NCCN, is it's irrational to me to go halfway. If you're going to have accelerated approval and you're going to throw the drug and its expense into some part of the population while you wait for full approval, you may as well be gambling with what you're testing. The half step makes no sense to me at all.
I mean, that makes sense, but I always saw the NCCN as commenting on what the evidence was and not necessarily reacting to the FDA. But whatever, I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying it's different.
I understand, but they had to do something because the FDA labeled it. So they could have simply endorsed the FDA, but I actually think the FDA's label is not easy to support.
So I think the bottom line, well, let me ask you. Bottom line is, what situations, if any, including this one with seven positive nodes, but maybe there are a lot of other situations, could a patient come to you with a HER2-positive tumor in the adjuvant situation, and if they say, you know, I'll pay for it, tell me what the best thing is to do, would you tell them to include a year of pertuzumab in treatment?
If they have a positive node or a tumor over 2 centimeters, in other words, if they would have qualified for the drug pre-op, then I would consider pertuzumab.
And for a year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, I want to be crystal clear because people may throw things at me in 2 years, and I know I could be wrong. It's just any duration of therapy will be repudiated if affinity is negative. If affinity is negative, the accelerated approval will be lost.
I mean, to me, it's not any different than any other situation where you have an extremely encouraging drug and you want to use it before you have definitive evidence and you don't have that much to lose.
The difference is it's labeled now specifically in the curative setting, and it is the vagaries of referral pattern that bother me.
Interesting.
That's the problem for me, that only some people would get it, just depending upon which specialist sees them first.
We're right now working on a program on breast cancer for surgeons. And one of the points that we're hammering home on that one is when you see a patient with a HER2-positive cancer, don't operate on them until they see the medical oncologist. And I mean, frankly, it's different if you have somebody HER2-positive or HER2-negative.
Right, but so the reason you're hammering on them for that is you don't want them to miss the chance to get pertuzumab.
Exactly.
But let me carry that through for you, because I want to get you as annoyed about this as I am. And so they learn your lesson. They refer them all. And 2 years goes by, and another 500 patients or 1,000 patients, and whatever it is, get 4 to 6 cycles of pertuzumab. That's what they get. That's the label. And then Affinity reports in 2018, and with Affinity, 80 to 90% of the patients are compliant with 12 months of drug. And there's a 3% or 5% absolute improvement in survival. Did you help these patients these years or not?
Again, I remember you probably do too. You know, for a long time, people thought tamoxifen didn't work in premenopausal women in the adjuvant setting.
But again, I want to stay on this one for 1 second, Neil, because these docs may not be accomplishing anything just by referring them for pre-op therapy if the docs who treat them stick to the label. You're not going to get an overall survival result that's linked to the duration of on-label pertuzumab. That's what I'm trying to make clear. So you're never going to know that this expenditure was worthwhile. And my passionate point of view here is if you're going to take a public health gamble, which we've already done, it's accelerated, not full approval, you may as well gamble on the thing that you're testing for the endpoint you care about.
You know, we always do these surveys of investigators and compare what they say.
They don't agree with me. The world doesn't agree
with me. Well, that's what I was going to say. This one's number one on my list.
But that's okay. You put it out there. And the interesting thing is I am prepared to talk about this till the cows come home because on the logic, you can't get away from the fact that I'm right. All it comes down to, and I've heard some of our best friends say, yes, but the data's not there, I don't agree. Okay, fine. Then you treat your patients for 4 months, and if affinity's positive in 2018, you call me up and tell me how proud you are that you gave a third of a year of pertuzumab. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying.
And by the way, let me take it to the last, to the dead end in the other direction. If affinity's negative, and I'm criticized because I overused the drug, I'll live with that because you're going to be criticized for the 4 or 6 cycles you gave too. Yeah, it was on label, but the label was wrong. So who cares?
Right, and I'm sure you've been debating this with your investigator colleagues. Do you think that most breast cancer investigators are attempting and successfully able to give adjuvant pertuzumab?
No.
Are they not doing that?
I think pre-op they can.
So they're not attempting to follow the NCCN thing at all, most investigators?
I don't know. Most of them think it's crazy, I guess.
Well, I guess a lot of people I've talked to are on the NCCN committee, so maybe that's a little biased.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, to be very fair, the NCCN committee had lots of discussions. It's a contentious point of view, and you made the point earlier that it seemed at odds with their usual way of doing business, and I can't disagree with you. But morally, I can't arrive at any alternative solution except to not use the drug at all. morally.
There's always the what would you do if it were you type of test. And you
know, it's what I would do for my patients. To hell with me.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me in this case. And honestly, Neil, I was so concerned about this that I will tell you, and they can never talk about it, I guess, but I met with the FDA before the label.
Hmm.
I espoused this point of view, and I explained to them my concerns.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, they could have not labeled it. They're the ones that opened this barn door.
Hmm. Let's talk about your 31-year-old case situation. Patient presents after mastectomy, ERPR positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, no BRCA mutation, 2.5 centimeters, 12 positive nodes. So you were part of the ASCO guidelines paper looking at endocrine therapy, and obviously the issue of endocrine therapy, particularly in premenopausal women, is undergoing a lot of thought nowadays. How do you think this one through?
Well, I mean, this case is one that's very real for me because the obvious question that this raises, putting aside pregnancy and fertility preservation, this is a young person with very high-risk disease, and they want to do everything. And the big global question, of course, has been ovarian function suppression. And unfortunately, we don't actually have a concrete answer for this right now. And so this has been an issue where people have been gambling one way or the other, and I can't criticize them. But, you know, making a 31-year-old menopausal to treat her for 10 years or 5 years even, it comes with a price in terms of quality of life, which not everybody gets, but many do, and we have to be sensitive to that. So obviously, with the soft and text trial presented at the plenary session of ASCO, there's even more light on this issue, but I don't know that there's clear resolution. So I just wanted to highlight the kinds of discussions we have. One, do we know that ovarian suppression adds to hormone therapy? And the answer is we still don't, because that wasn't reported with soft text. That arm of tamoxifen alone, the control arm, wasn't included in this result. We hope to hear that at San Antonio. That's my understanding, but we'll see. Obviously, if there's a step up when you ablate ovarian function in the soft and text trials, especially obviously soft, then that, I think, could be the final game changer for us more than a century after Beetson and his oophorectomies. The second issue, though, is the specific results of soft text, where there really was a statistically significant improvement in the AI plus ovarian suppression as opposed to tamoxifen plus ovarian suppression. Some will say at this point, if the ovarian suppression and AI arm was better than ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen, the only way that's not better than tamoxifen alone is if tamoxifen is better than ovarian suppression and tamoxifen. Right? It's a little algebraic, but that's an argument that holds some water for me. It would seem spurious to me to discover that ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen is inferior to tamoxifen alone. And so that can motivate a change in practice. And then I just want to throw one more thing in there, of course. Although the numbers are small, of course, the overall survival doesn't support any of this, right? The overall survival actually favored tamoxifen numerically without statistical significance. And so for me, the one thing is 12 positive nodes, young person. I'm not saying that every young person should have ovarian ablation and an AI, but this is the patient where I would offer it.
And with an AI?
Yeah.
Which one?
Oh, I don't know. It doesn't matter.
Okay. What about duration, planned duration of treatment? That was commented on in the ASCO paper.
Yeah, that's another complicated issue right now. So you and I have been doing this a long time, so we've watched this evolve. Starting with the establishment that 5 years of tamoxifen was better than shorter durations, we had the B14 data, which some, Peto leading the charge, have argued was overinterpreted for 10 years being inferior to 5, but there it was. So that's the benchmark against which the AIs were arbitrarily established, but nobody ever set out to determine the AI duration. They just benched it against the established 5-year metric. So then you've got basically 3 studies that are big that suggest that aiming for 10 years of therapy is better than 5. 2 of them are tamoxifen, Atlas and Atom, and 1, of course, is the MA17. The makeup of the treatment varies. In 2 of them, it's just tamoxifen, and in 1 of them, it's the sequence, tamoxifen and then the AI. But from a concept point of view, what they have in common, along with some smaller studies that we referred to in the guideline from ASCO, is that a duration of 10 years really may be better than 5. And so I've been struggling with this. What do you do with a patient who was 56, had 6 positive lymph nodes and is now 61, finishing 5 years of AI. Do you stop or continue? MA17R is the re-randomization of the letrozole patients for a third block of 5 years, but we don't have the answer there. If you buy the principle that 10 years of therapy is better than 5, you might err in that direction. If the patient has excessive toxicity and you don't have data that 10 years is better than 5, you might stop. And I think these are, honestly, if you add up the total counseling time in my clinic these days, this is probably the issue that consumes the most after obesity and weight control.
And if you had to sort of globally guess, given all the different personalities involved, the toxicities, experience in general, if you had 100 people like the one you described, you know, with multiple positive nodes.
I think most of them stay on therapy with 12 positive nodes because the fear of recurrence is the dominant risk.
Hmm.
And they would rather wake up and discover that they had overtreated it than ever wake up with disease and regret that they might have missed the opportunity to treat.
As long as we're asking Talmudic questions, would you like to take a shot at the role of bisphosphonates nowadays?
I don't have an answer because, as you know, the data remains cloudy. So certainly we're not routinely offering it as adjuvant therapy, but we give it according to guidelines for bone health.
So the last scenario you brought out was a triple negative scenario, 41-year-old lady, post-op for a 3.5 centimeter node negative triple negative disease. The issue of fertility preservation. We saw some really interesting data regarding that at ASCO.
Yeah, I thought in some ways that Holly Moore's abstract from SWOG was, from a practical perspective, one of the most high-impact abstracts at the meeting. And the reason is it asked a pragmatic and important lifestyle, if you will, question that has been plaguing us for a long time. And I think it's worth a minute to talk about the background and then get back to this 41-year-old. So are there safe ways to preserve fertility for the young patients that we're trying to cure breast cancer? And the answer has not been an evidence-based answer ever. So lots of people harvest eggs and fertilize them, freeze them, and that raises all kinds of issues, and not the least of which is the expense and the viability and so forth. But fine, we have these programs, and it's really important. Again, so much so that there's ASCO position papers, guidelines on fertility preservation. A lot of the pediatricians and others treating young people, women with cancer, have been using LHRH agonists for years to put the ovaries at rest, and it was empiric. Kevin Fox and the group at Penn did a small prospective study, if I remember correctly, of about 20 patients years ago, and they weren't able to do much in terms of proving preservation. I think there were no pregnancies. So what the SWOG investigators did is they took patients with hormone-insensitive cancer, the idea being that the results wouldn't be confounded by any hormone effect and or other hormone therapies. Also, that they wouldn't be on prolonged hormone therapy, so that pregnancy might be a possible early event. And they randomized them to get, I think it was the gosurilin. And so they randomized them to get it or not. And they used surrogates for fertility, which was the resumption of normal menses about 24 months after finishing treatment. They would look back 6 months from that point. So 18 to 24 months, are you having regular periods or not? Obviously, if you're not having periods, your chance of fertility is lower. And they used blood tests, FSH, LH, and estrogen, to look at the likelihood that you were premenopausal. And those results clearly demonstrated that, at least in terms of surrogates, this approach might have increased fertility. But I think the thing that really catches your eye is that with just over 200 patients randomized, there were just about twice as many pregnancies in the group that was preserved or blocked versus not. Now, again, you can't randomize people to try to get pregnant, and the numbers are small enough that one can't be 100% sure that it's just an effect of the drug. But it's reassuring, because it's the first time that anybody has shown a portfolio of consistent beneficial effects for this approach, suggesting that we actually are no longer powerless. We can do something for young people. And this patient, the 41-year-old, raises lots of difficult issues that always come up. You know, the person's professional. They've waited till a little later in life to start a family. Now they have breast cancer. They're desperate to actually have that first child. What can we do? And the answer is not a whole lot historically. Well, today, we can at least offer, in addition to routine fertility preservation, egg harvesting, so forth, we can offer them essentially ovarian rest to try to maintain the premenopausal state for this person. Interestingly, those patients who were randomized to gosurilin had a trend towards better outcomes anyway from a disease-specific point of view. I'm not saying it's helpful. I am saying that it's reassuring as a trend. So this case just brings it into sharp focus because of the age at 41. But I actually think that this result from ASCO this year has implications well beyond breast cancer. I think that this is going to provide some backing for most young people getting chemotherapy to think about these drugs.
What do we know about this issue in terms of laboratory research? It would seem like you could study, you know, what the impact is in an animal of chemotherapy with or without ovarian suppression.
Yeah, there are animals. Octe and others have been doing this kind of work, as I understand it. I'm not more familiar with it than that. But there is evidence that this approach would be protective.
So would you say to this lady, I'm going to send you into a fertility specialist, you can consider...
Absolutely. You got to harvest.
Harvest and do all that.
But
you'll
I'll
do that
this
too.
Yep. Absolutely.
And how long before the chemo do you start?
I think it's a few weeks, but I'd have to double check the abstract to see exactly how
right.
they did it.
So
it may just be a few days. I mean, because a lot of these people, I think, probably get started pretty quickly. I just don't remember.
Yeah, you would think so. So is this sort of practice changing for you? In other words, you didn't do it before ASCO, now you're doing it?
I never did it before ASCO, and I would routinely consider it today.
The thing that was interesting is we actually, for ASCO, had presented this scenario. It was a doc in practice who wanted to do it, and most of the docs, not knowing what was going to be presented at ASCO, said, no, I don't do that.
Right.
We should go back to them and see if they changed their
I
mind.
I can't imagine that they won't. You know, certainly from the lay press, this got among the highest degree of attention.
Just for nostalgic purposes, I guess, maybe you'll find more than that. I'm curious about the paper that was published in the JCO from the CLGB 40101. Looking at AC versus paclitaxel as adjuvant therapy, women with 0 to 3 positive nodes.
Yeah, so this was the last big adjuvant chemotherapy trial that we designed in the CLGB. It really was the next step in our dose-dense chemotherapy development. And it tackled, again, it's got an echo of some of the discussions we've had, because like the ovarian suppression for treatment of breast cancer, it was kind of an age-old question. Are 6 cycles of therapy really better than 4? And lots of people had passionate views about that going back for decades. You know, when ACT was better than AC, some argued it was just getting more cycles of therapy in, not that the paclitaxel mattered at the time. And so this was a study that was initially set up to test that question in a 2x2 factorial design. It was AC times 4 or AC times 6, and it was 12 or 18 weeks of low-dose weekly paclitaxel. That's how the study began. And after somewhere around 500 patients, this is how old the study was, because it was an 01. It was a 2001 design. So in 2003, the Mark Citrin data came out. And at that point, we knew that dose-dense therapy was superior. And so we modified this trial and made it even more symmetrical. It was just Q2-week therapy for everybody. And it was either 4 or 6. And it was either single-agent paclitaxel or AC. That was it. And we reported about a year and a half, 2 years ago, the first part of the study, which was 6 versus 4. And interestingly, 6 was not one bit better than 4. The numbers actually suggested 4 looked better, but it's not that it's better, but it wasn't worse. And this is important, because just pause for a second. How many years did you hear people saying that CAF for 6 cycles was better than 4 of AC, or that the various regimens using FEC and FAC had to be better than AC because it was 2 more cycles, and that you didn't need to give docetaxel or paclitaxel as long as you gave 6 cycles because they were better. This study just knocks that one out of the park, right? 4 cycles was as good as 6. The second question, which relates to a degree to the TC versus AC discussion and others, was, is single agent taxane just as good as anything else? Weekly paclitaxel, of course, has never been beaten by any single agent chemotherapy in advanced breast cancer. Never been beaten, right?
What about here?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. So historically, you had reason to hope that if you could give paclitaxel alone, yeah, you have neuropathy and certainly some hair loss, but you have much less myelosuppression, much less febrile neutropenia, no emesis and no heart failure, no known leukemia risk in the long term. So we hoped that we might be able to demonstrate that we could get away with just paclitaxel. And some people have argued for that in the past. But interestingly, echoing in a way what we saw in 49907, which was capecitabine as a single agent, here the single
the
agent...
older patient study.
Yeah, but the same idea is that a single agent chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting has really never matched up to a combination. That's true in the overview, and that's true here again. So we've settled on AC times 4 as a kind of minimal and acceptable chemotherapy. Now, that doesn't resolve where the TC might fit into your thinking or other open questions about chemotherapy. And I don't know that we'll get answers to those questions. But certainly for the clinicians who would occasionally see a sick or frail or compromised patient and be tempted to use single-agent paclitaxel, this says that you really can't count on that.
When you look back on this whole thing, other than the empiric observation that the patients did better and got through therapy better, are you convinced that dose-dense chemotherapy is more effective than various versions of non-dose-dense, including weekly paclitaxel?
The only way to actually answer the question scientifically is to have properly conducted randomized trials that control for all the variables. So as you know, there are just a few studies that have actually asked the question. As soon as you do TAC with docetaxel AC at different doses Q3 as compared to ACT in like the NSABP study that Sandy reported, you can't claim that you're testing dose density. You're just not. The only way you can test dose density is to do what we did in the CLGB at the time, which was give exactly the same doses, exactly the same administration of drug. The only variable was the schedule. And in those settings, it's true that the GONO study was not positive with CEF or FEC chemotherapy. But of course, that's because in the end, their control arm massively outperformed their projections, so their study was underpowered. It's not a, to be very clear, you can't label the GONO study as a definitive negative. All you can say is that it failed to be positive. And I know it sounds like I'm tap dancing, but I'm not. It's an underpowered study. And so I think you got to watch this space because I think that the underlying principle remains correct. I think that worldwide overview is planned for this question, and you'll have to see what it shows. But I find it hard to believe that well-conducted, adequately powered studies of dose density will not continue to be positive. Now, you keep asking about weekly paclitaxel. To me, that's a practical question, and it may be that giving low-dose weekly paclitaxel is better still. We have one direct comparison from the SWOG 0221, where there really was no meaningful difference between the two schedules apart from toxicity. So I can't argue that, but that's not a dose density question. That's a more complicated question of number of administrations, schedule, and dose size. So from a practical point of view, do I object to weekly paclitaxel? No, and it may be for many patients easier because it's no growth factor and it's 1 hour each treatment instead of three. But of course, it's more treatments, so that's an inconvenience.
How about non-dose dense AC?
Well, I just would never give it to anybody for any reason.